Hey, everybody. Adam Shartoff here. Before we get started, I just wanted to let you know about a special screening happening in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, this coming Thursday, November the 2nd at 9 o'clock p.m. I'm going to be joined by the filmmakers behind the cult film called Chief Zabu. It's a comedy co-directed by Zach Norman and Neil Cohen, both of whom will be joining me for Q&A and some stand-up comedy and more at Videology, which is at 308 Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. So if you're free, please go check out the Videology website and get your tickets. There's still some room left, and we'd love to sell the event out. And I will be there, and we'll see you. Coming up in this podcast episode is the filmmakers who I met with over the summer, and I'm going to be playing that for you just after a little bit of business here.
This is John Borman, and I made Queen and Country, and I'm very glad to be appearing on Filmwax Radio.
Thank you. This is, again, Adam Shartoff. You're listening to episode number 438 of the podcast. Filmwax Radio is the name of the show, and we have two wonderful segments. As I mentioned in the lead-up into the theme song there, we have the filmmakers Zach Norman and Neil Cohen, who have become friends of mine because of we've been just meeting up and talking about doing this screening together for the longest time. They have this movie they made in the mid-80s, and they never had gotten the opportunity to finish it and to get it out in the world. And so finally, in 2017, that's just what they're doing. And instead of doing this, the conventional theatrical, what they've been doing, because Zach is a bit of the funny man, and his character that he plays, which is a variation of himself, is a would-be comedian. He's also doing some stand-up, so they've been booking the film in various comedy clubs around the country. Doing it at Videology is a bit of a break, but again, if you're nearby, if you're in Brooklyn, you want to come down, join me and Zach and Neil, please do consider coming in. I think there's a few, I'm not kidding when I say this event is going to be sold out in a matter of a couple more days. I'm pretty sure of it. It's a small venue, but we're going to have a great amount of fun. Some people may know Zach Norman from his collaborations with the filmmaker Henry Jaglom, as well as being a character actor in a bunch of other, like Romancing the Stone. I think he was Danny DeVito's sidekick. He had a very small but memorable role in a movie called Fingers. He's done many other films. So that's happening again on Thursday at Videology in Williamsburg. We're going to get to that segment, talking about why they made it in the 86, I think it was, and then it took them 30 years to get the film out in the world. What happened? We're going to talk to them about all of that. And then following that will be a wonderful conversation with Griffin Dunn, the actor, the producer, the director, and now documentary filmmaker. I've been wanting to bring Griffin back on the podcast since he was on the first time, which is on, if you go back and find episode number 213 from May of 2014. So, wow, it's been over 3 years. But Griffin Dunn was on with filmmaker Justin Schwartz with their film The Discoverers. It was a indie comedy. Griffin is finally back on after all these years by himself because he made his first documentary feature called Joan Didion, The Center Will Not Hold. Joan Didion, as many people may know, the author, is the aunt of Griffin Dunn. So it's a very much, and she's alive in her 80s. And the film is really just her story and about the family, her relationship with her husband, John Gregory Dunn, himself an author, and their child, their adopted daughter, Quintana, and their relationships to Griffin, who plays a smaller role, but it's also they've got friends, in the movie. But it's a lot of archive. It's a beautiful story, told in a very beautiful and very very moving way, I might add. If you hear any noise behind me, I'm sorry. They're doing construction downstairs, and if you can hear it, which is pretty impressive considering the windows are closed. So I apologize if you hear any drilling going on. Anyway, I saw Joan Didion, The Center Will Not Hold, at the New York Film Festival, And it will be having a theatrical at the Metrograph Cinema downtown in New York City. If you get a chance, please go and check it out. It's opening tomorrow, Friday, the 27th of October, but it will also be available on Netflix. So people all over the place can see this very, very, worthwhile documentary about Joan Didion. And even if you don't know her work, like I have not read much of Joan Didion. I think I read the piece she wrote when John Gregory died, The Year of Magical Thinking, which I thought was terrific. I mean, sad, but terrific. But anyway, so now I'm all motivated to, of course, bring him on. Anyway, we're going to get to that in just a little bit, but up here first is going to be Neil Cohen, and who's a filmmaker and a screenwriter, and Zach Norman, the character actor, and their story and what's going on. And so you can Google it. There's a Chief Zabu website. You can see all sorts of the trailer, which we're going to play a little bit of in a minute. And you can keep in touch with Chief Zabu, and they're on Facebook and everything else. So you can keep in touch with them, see if they're going to come to. I think we're going to get them back in Brooklyn next spring as well for another screening. But in the meantime, you should check it out. The Alan Garfield is in it, the actor. Alan Arbus, who people may remember from MASH, is in it. Ed Lauder, the great character actor who passed away a few years ago, is in it. And Zach Norman himself is in it. It's a fun comedy. It's crazy. It's offbeat. It's memorable. You'll be glad you have seen it. There's nowhere else to see it, but unless you come down to these venues and see that, because it's not available online and won't be for some time. So if you want to have a great time, first listen to my conversation coming up right now with the co-directors of Chief Zabu, again, Neil Cohen, and Zach Norman, here on Film Wax Radio.
I want to be a human being. I want to see my name on hospital wings. I want to donate money to hospitals for underpoverished people. Do you know what I'm saying? I want to have public opinions. I want to have opinions on issues. I want people to say, there's Ben Sidney.
That's right.
He built that.
You ready for this? Look what? Over there. That's what? The Ben Sidney Pavilion.
I love that. Okay.
The American dream does not exclude anyone. Not even these two.
You see this little island here?
Yeah.
This could be ours.
A million? You're going to make more than a million. A million is nothing.
The profits from this operation will run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, Chief Zabu is the new president of Tibiraco.
We got a shot at the soft drink rights and the fishing rights.
You can get the contract to build all of those roads.
Got a smart boy here, Ben.
I want to meet the chief.
Not now. He's under tremendous pressure right now.
I want to meet Chief Zabu.
Chief, this is Ben Sidney.
I'm sitting with Neil Cohen and Zach Norman, co-directors of... Can we say that you're one of the co-directors, by the way? Because,
sure,
because
absolutely.
Zach, because you go by a pseudo-moniker.
The pseudo-moniker is Zach Norman.
Well, it was Howard Zucker.
Zucker. Moved to New York.
Yeah.
The Zuckers went to Boston.
Uh-huh.
That's what happened. They dropped a C and went to Boston.
So wait, I'm trying to follow. I'm a little slow anyway, so
when those people
forgive.
Came over, let me put
yours,
it this way.
Yours peoples.
Those people, I'm talking about a mass of people, some...
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're talking about when they came to New York from the old country.
They really come from the old company, and their names, yeah, their names, by the way, the derivation is really Zucker.
I understand. They were German Jews.
Which means sugar.
Is that true? Oh, I
sure.
Guess that, yeah.
My grandfather came to Ellis Island, and they said, what's your name? He said, Zucker.
What's your name, sweetheart?
Sweetie. That's right. Sweetheart. Zucker.
But he said they were Zucker. German Jews.
He said, look, that's sugar, so your name now is Sugarman. Go.
Got it.
And he wore Sugarman for 3 years. He walked around. His name was Chaim Sugarman.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of his one day walked down the street, and he said, Zucker. And he said, no, I'm now Sugarman. He said, schmuck. Go back and change it. You are a Zucker.
Right. So your dad. This was your dad or granddad?
No, my grandfather.
Your granddad.
And my grandfather, when he got to Boston, they explained to him, Zucker, it's Zucker. It's Zucker. You park over there and your name is Zucker.
I got it.
That's the way
it is. They butchered every way you could pronounce it. They somehow...
To this poor little guy whose name was Sugarman ended up a Zucker and then a Zucker.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's your... And then you went in, of course, decided to
change it
for showbiz.
Because my father's name, I became Norman.
Your dad's name was Norman
Zucker? No, his name was Sidney, so I changed his name to Norman.
Got it.
Wouldn't you if you were me?
I absolutely would. In fact, I'm considering it right now.
Sure.
And by the way, while we're on the subject, there's also one other time, and then we're going to get to Neil in a minute. But
yes.
Asa, can you do me a favor and also just... Or what are you doing? Oh, sure. Can you just get the kit over there, the blue bag, my bag here? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I have my little crib notes here, too, which I don't always take, but I wanted to make sure, because you guys have long career, so I kind of wanted to just jot a few notes down, but there's also, I wanted to get the name right, because there's also one more AKA, which is also a name I'm curious about, which is isolated to a filmmaker you have a long history with, and that is Kaz Naiman.
It's
another name,
Naiman,
which you've used repeatedly through all sorts of films.
It's at one particular character that was in a bunch of films by Henry Jaglom.
Okay, that's
right. So that's how it happened. And how that happened is because my dog's name is Kaz.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So it all makes sense.
It
and
does.
My therapist, my psychiatrist's name is Naiman.
Okay.
And he was just great. It made a big difference in my life.
The dog or the psychiatrist?
Oh, no, the psychiatrist. The dog has first billing, but the psychiatrist was very helpful.
And how long did you go to him, or how long have you been going?
Not long. I went to him for about 31 years.
Yeah.
And then I stopped.
Yeah, of course. Well... You know better.
But my best name, you didn't get at all.
Okay.
I was working in the real estate business, and I was in Boston, and I was building a building with my partner, who was my cousin, older than me, and I wanted to keep it quiet that I had taken a job in the local theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to come up with another name. It couldn't be Howard Zucker, and it wasn't... Yeah, I didn't know Zach Norman at that point, so I called myself Lance Lipschitz. And it worked great until one day on a Sunday, my picture was in the Boston Globe, and it said, opening Wednesday, Lance Lipschitz and the Good Woman of Szechuan. And I got a call from my partner at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. I hadn't seen the paper.
Hysterical.
Hysterical? No, I think he was contained. He said, is this you, Lance? What is this, Lance? That was that. I soon left the real estate business.
Yeah. Well, it comes up in your character, Sidney. Well, you know, this is, Sam. No, your name is Sammy Brooks. Right? In the film... Which is loosely why we're meeting here today, actually, right? We're talking about Chief Zabu, which is the movie you started in 1986 with Neil.
That's right.
And which recently we're able to finally finish, and which now you guys are self-distributing, I guess, for the moment. So let's hear it from Neil. What? I can't hear anything.
Oh, yeah, we're doing a tour of comedy clubs. That's where we're showing the picture.
Huh?
We were... at a film festival in Florida.
Yeah.
And the theater was adjacent to a comedy club. And there weren't a lot of people going into the theater, but there was a big line of people to go to the comedy club. So we started handing out flyers to the people online in the comedy club, and they all migrated over to the theater to watch Chief Zabu.
Is that right? Oh, okay.
And we did a little comedy introduction and a little comedy Q&A, and we said, well, everybody who was online at the comedy club was going to see comedy.
Uh-huh.
Anyone who was going to the multiplex might not be. So why don't we release the picture in comedy clubs?
Yeah.
And so we said, oh, that sounds like a great idea, but... are we the only one who are going to buy this idea? So we started sending out cold emails to comedy clubs around L.A. and around the country. And literally, we didn't know any. It was just two attention to.
Sure, sure.
And every one of them wrote back to us and said, this sounds like so much fun. We read your reviews. We saw what this is about. Let's do it.
Right.
So we did a club date at the Nerdist in Hollywood, very hip place.
Right. They do a bunch of podcasts.
Yeah. And then we did West Side Comedy. Mm-hmm. And now we're doing Stand Up New York in Manhattan, where part of the movie was actually filmed. We're booked into the Draft House in Washington, D.C. We're doing talking to the Harold Ramis Theater in Chicago and building a tour out of it.
It's a unique way of distributing your film. Or exhibiting your film, and it shows, gumption, and it's good, because, you know, other people may have given up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're not, it's a difficult film, because it's in the sense, in terms of conventional distribution, because everybody wants a new film, and it's got to have, you know, like some young star in it or something like that in many cases, or I don't know. But, well, I mean, I feel like it has a home online, of course, because I think, you know, there'll just a lot of people will find it there. But you know, theatrically speaking, I could see why it's a little bit
difficult. I mean, it's a curious sell, because what we're finding is younger audiences are drawn to the picture because they haven't been exposed to this sign. Sort of filmmaking, this sort of comedy.
Right.
They've never seen any of these great famous character actors.
It's wonderful.
And one of the hooks that we're finding is their parents didn't see this movie. So it's not like their parents are saying, go see Chief Zabu.
Yeah.
These people at colleges around the country and people go to, they're telling their parents, hey, look what I discovered. That, and the 80s are kind of hot now. So the fashion and the music and the cars.
Oh, I just thought people in their 80s is what you're referring to.
Exactly. We've been getting a terrific response, but it's almost like it's a fresh experience for people because it's been sort of in a crypt that nobody's seen this thing for 30 years.
Right. And as we said already, Zach's character, Sammy Brooks, is also, he's in real estate, but it's one of those cases where he feels like he's wasting his life doing real estate. He's not happy about it. His dreams are to be a stand-up comedian. And so in fact, there is a deep connection there. It's a natural connection.
Absolutely, a natural connection to my life.
Yes, you too.
Because real estate,
right.
I really thought that I was told that if you make a lot of money, you're very, very happy. And all of a sudden, I made a lot of money. And I was miserable.
You were?
Yeah. So I looked, what is it that I want to do? And what I wanted to do was a little stand-up comedy. And I did. I left the real estate business, went off to Europe, and entertained all the troops in France, Germany, Italy. 1966.
So would this have been during one of our... One of our attempts to help third world countries, like in Vietnam, or was it Southeast Asia?
'66.
So.
That was all just beginning in '66 and '65.
It was, exactly. So I'm wondering when. But we were stationed over there since Korea, probably, in that part of the world, right?
But it was pretty peaceful over there.
Okay.
And the only thing that wasn't peaceful, really, with the clubs I was working, you know, for other reasons.
Understood.
But nothing to do with war. But it was a great, great experience, you know.
Uh-huh.
But what we learned, which is so amazing, is the very stuff that this movie laughs at and enjoys talking about, all these people we thought would be our clients, our fans, our customers. But when these older people come in who are in business, they look at this picture and they say, wait a second, what is this? Why are they making fun of us? You know?
Yeah.
But the young people, they say, this is funny. Look at these guys.
Right.
You know, they are really stupid. They don't understand that they soon will become those people.
Right.
But that's another story.
It's the natural cycle
yes.
that is,
yes.
right, that in life. It's mentioned
true. How it plays differently in comedy clubs. And indeed, the story of Chief Zabu, it's about a New York real estate developer who dreams of having political influence. And that character is played by the great Alan Garfield, one of the great actors. So here we are with a sort of Trumpian character, a New York realtor who dreams of having political influence. What's interesting is in the second banana in this is played by Zach, who's a real estate guy who dreams of having a career in comedy.
Right.
And there's a line where Zach says, I hate real estate. Don't you think I'd like to make a living being a comedian? And in a conventional theater, that's a plot point. When we play it in a comedy club, which is filled with comics, that gets a huge laugh.
Sure. It's contextual. It's more contextually appropriate place to show the film. But I also wanted to mention just arbitrarily a scene, which is, you know, we're sitting right now. I should mention to listeners that we're sitting in a hotel in Midtown, just a few doors down from Carnegie Hall, in fact. But we're sitting amidst, we're located amidst a lot of skyscrapers and very tall buildings. No surprise, but it calls to mind. There's a scene, a wonderful scene, where Zach, who early on is showing an apartment to a young couple, and it's a great routine. Was this something completely scripted, or how much of it were in these cases? Because you go through this whole thing, they're clearly nowhere near the river. But of course,
that's your perspective.
This is one of those, not a realtor's, of course. But I understand that if you put a mirror up against this wall by the window, and you open the window, you stand in a particular spot, you might see a tiny bit of what looks like maybe somebody's river.
If you can see a river, it's
a river view.
A river view, and that's the key to the deal.
That was always a cliche. It was a cliche from the selling point
in everything that we sold. I wanted to know, and people want to know, what are you interested in? What would you like?
Uh-huh.
And if somebody says, "I like a nice view," then they'll have a view. Now, if they want something else, we can find that too.
Yeah.
You know, look how warm it is here. You see outside, it's cold? That's why you want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be here because it's warm.
Right.
And you leave it at that. And they look at you as if you're insane.
Yeah.
But eventually, you know, we try to...
And they always come back because they see everything else. And then how little...
It's great. But what Neil said is really true. One of the ironic things that happened with this movie is Donald Trump. It really resonates here.
Yeah.
And this is 31 years since we shot the thing. But in this movie, we were driving and wrote in the movie. And it's there, if you remember, when I'm in the car with Alan... or I should say Ben Sidney.
Alan Garfield's character.
Yes, Alan Garfield's character. I say to him, you know, look over there. You see that sign? And the big sign on the highway said the Trump Pavilion. And that sign still exists right over in, where is it? Queens.
Yeah.
And that sign, the Trump Pavilion, is twice the size of the name of the hospital. So I said to Alan in the movie, someday it's going to be the Ben Sidney Pavilion. And he said, I like that, as he looked at that big sign in the hospital. But because, and I didn't even think about it, but because he won the presidency, the amazing connection that has evolved between Ben Sidney and Donald Trump.
It's become more
it's almost
profound.
Impossible to have comprehended because,
You
know, that sign, incidentally, was for Fred Trump, his father.
Right.
He wasn't around.
He's the first racist. The first realtor. Sorry. I want to take a baby step back because we just kind of started to describe the plot, which is about these two business partners in the real estate game. One wants to be, as we said, essentially a politician or someone with political influence anyway, and the other one wants to be a comedian. And they have all of a sudden an opportunity to invest. They don't have money necessarily to invest, but they have an opportunity to invest in this fabled, Polynesian island called
Tibaraku.
Tibaraku, okay, which is
getting its independence from France.
From France, okay. And it is, I guess, run by this
Chief Zabu,
who is a part-time store clerk.
He runs a hardware store.
He runs a hardware store, excuse me.
Duly elected as president.
Sure.
And he's come to New
York.
Not
a huge leap from real estate broker or real estate owner to to somebody who works in a hardware business.
Exactly.
You know.
And he's in New York trying to raise money as he's getting his independence from France to develop his newly independent country. And hoping to raise enough money from various business people to do development, build roads and factories and power plants and such things. He's got only one problem. The French are testing nuclear weapons near his island. And they don't want him to stop.
Marketing. It's a challenging marketing.
It's a challenging marketing
issue.
Thing.
Yeah.
It's a thing that's not in the brochure. They don't put that in the brochure that bombs are being tested near the island. And in fact, when we wrote the movie, this was an actual issue. It sounds like we've made up some Peter Sellers preposterous plot, but in the 80s when we made the movie...
And Ronald Reagan was the president.
Right. There were a number of French colonies that were working on getting their independence, New Caledonia and places like that.
Okay.
And part of the deal, though, for them to get their independence was they weren't going to question the open-air French nuclear tests that were going on in the Pacific.
The people's first reactions is, of course, horror and astonishment at this and that this should be going on anywhere near their island or their home.
Right.
But the sun sets.
The sunsets, absolutely.
It's everything is a bit of a give and a take.
Exactly.
You can't get those sunsets just anywhere.
It's all those little particles that you need new, physics to make happen.
You make me think about dusk at Hiroshima.
Now I'm going to feel bad that I made a joke like that. Jesus Christ.
So it was actually based on real events that were happening at the time.
Uh-huh.
And, we said, okay, this is a pretty heavy subject. What if we took this heavy subject and did it as our version of a Marx Brothers movie?
It's right. This is a satire.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So we have, without spending too much time focusing on plot. I mean, we have the basic broad strokes, but I do want to mention the reason I want to is because I want to also bring in a few of the other actors who are in here.
Oh, yeah.
So describing their character a little bit. For instance, you mentioned that, Zabu is interested in finding investors. So essentially the point person for that is played by actor, the great Alan Arbus.
Ah, brilliant.
Who most people, at least people of, I guess anybody maybe over the age of 30, 40 years old will remember from MASH as Dr. Sidney Friedman, who that's how I came. I didn't know that he was a photographer and married to Dion Arbus, and I didn't know that until later on. I just knew him as Alan Alda's psychiatrist.
Right.
So you got him, which was amazing. It was great. And I guess MASH was probably just ended right before this, because didn't they end in the early 80s?
May have been.
And so, of course, as I already mentioned, the two lead characters are there to... Now they have this opportunity. They have to find the money.
Right.
So they find Deep Pockets.
Right.
Which is in this family couple in upstate New York.
Right. Played by Ed Lauder.
Recently deceased Ed Lauder.
Yeah.
I guess in the last two or three years he passed away. What a great actor that guy
was.
Who knew what a great comedic actor he was,
Well, the thing
by the
is,
way.
When we called his agent...
So you had him in mind?
We had him in mind. Okay. In those days, there was a thing. There was no internet. But there was a thing called the Player's Guide.
Yeah.
And the Player's Guide it looked like a Yellow Pages, but most of your listeners don't know what a Yellow Pages are. So imagine a Sears Roebuck. Well, I guess then we would go further back. But imagine something, an encyclopedia. Well, I guess you wouldn't know what that looks. Okay, so imagine a large paper book that had thousands of pages that had stamp, well, you don't know what stamps are, but thumb-sized pictures of actors, okay. Pages and pages and pages, and you would go through that and they would have their contact information. So we were going through looking for an actor to play this guy Skippy, and there we saw Ed Lauder. So we said, you know, he's a very serious guy, but he makes us laugh when we look at his picture. Let's call his agent. So we called his agent and we said, we have no money. It's a low budget independent picture, but would he be interested in playing this comic role? And the guy said, don't even send the script. The answer is yes. What nobody knows is Ed started as a stand-up comedian and has never been able to get a comic role in Hollywood.
Ever since he became a heavy, you know, because that was his
he was a guy, he was a prison guard always, on a chain gang.
Tough.
Tough, mean, a gangster, a sheriff. And you're offering a comic role, I'm telling you, he's going to want to do it. So that's how that came to be.
And when he met us, and he was the guy. He was just terrific right from the get-go.
Can you tell me also, since we're I had the sense that he was just a really talented guy who, like many actors, maybe you can even speak from this experience, Zach, that, you know, banded it because of their look and that they end up being a character actor or because of even their choice. I mean, I know that my kid's mom is a professional actress and she's gorgeous, but she wanted a career as a character actor, essentially, even though she has lead roles. I don't mean to say that you don't lead films. You do in this case. Sitting Ducks, I want to mention, one of my favorite films you've done.
You.
I love that movie. Yeah. And you're a lead in that. And it's
well,
also...
I'm a lead, but it's not a conventional leading man.
Right. I'm saying is that even a character actor can lead a film or star in a film.
Exactly. Now, you see, I became a character actor not of my own choice. I used to think of myself as a leading man, and I would throw my hair back. That was before I lost
Donald
my
Trump
hair.
Knows not
yes,
to do that.
Yes. But all of a sudden, as I got older, I realized they didn't think of me as a leading man. And that was that. So I became when I did get a lead in a movie, he was a bald leading man, you know.
Well, not all the time, but most of the time. But I want to say something about that because I'm kind of interested in your response. And that is that your persona is often, like in many of the films, and Henry, who you've collaborated with many, many times, allowed you to bring a lot to each role. And I, at least that's what I think.
I think
there's a persona that comes through, and that persona is actually of a virile leading man type.
Well,
even, you know what I'm saying? In other words, I don't get that necessarily from most character actors, but I feel like there is a brash, confidence that you bring to your roles, which is kind of closer to choices a leading man would make, actually.
Well, you know, I never differentiated, but what I did learn in acting school, that the greatest thing anybody can bring to a role and uniquely bring to a role is what they are themselves as a human being. So even though it's not the same person in each role that I do, they're all part of me.
About when you were beaten up and you were left by a woman or your mom.
When I was beaten
you
up,
or
yes,
all these
of
things.
Course.
I thought this was acting class.
It is acting, but you have to be beaten. If you want to play a real good beaten man, get beaten. I mean, haven't you heard that in all the books?
Of course. I read Stanislavski and Uta Hagen.
You know, and it's, you say Uta Hagen, I never forget my first meeting with Uta Hagen. I went to see her for an interview about joining her class. And she talked to me and looked at me and she said, I don't think so. And that was my Uta Hagen story.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, it was disappointing.
It's disappointing
I ended up with Sandy Meisner.
Well, I was going to say Meisner approach is
great. Yeah, no, he was terrific. John Voight was a classmate of mine.
Not Ooh. Heard of that guy, but continue, please.
That's right. Well, he can't get the leading man roles, and
but let's say. But I appreciate John Voight too, because he also, I mean, for as long as he could, he avoided. I don't think he had a typical leading man. He had the looks and the height and the build
and
certainly the talent, but he chose a very unconventional series of roles as well.
Well, John, I just want you to know, was the nicest person in the class, and I didn't understand people like that. He used to come in and say to me, "Hey, how are you?" And I'd say, what
You're
does
suspicious.
This guy want?
Yeah, right.
what is he looking for? And he was loved, I mean loved, by Sandy Meisner. So Meisner knew something real strong, because that was his choice, mm-hmm. John Voight. And then I would come up, and John would do a scene, and he would literally talk to him for an hour and a half about all the nuances, the little moves that John made. And then I would come up. And he picked a specific girl for me to be my partner. I won't go into the detail of it, but there we were as partners. And we would say, go ahead and do your scene. And when I finished, he always said the same thing. Excellent. Very good. Next. So I always got the impression that John was the way to go. And he was right.
It's interesting as we speak, because I think he's doing that actor is, I think, doing some of his best work.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, on that series. And
I mean, I ran into him in France, you know, 20 years. He's the nicest guy. He remains the nicest guy and a serious and wonderful actor.
Yeah.
So it goes both ways.
Just,
I mean,
so in his fiber. Yeah. I don't mean to get off on some, you know, other track here, but I mean, I'm just reminded of the work he's doing on Ray Donovan.
I ran into him 2 weeks ago
on
getting coffee online in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
And I just had to say to him, you know, I want to thank you for giving so much pleasure as an actor. And he did a picture called Runaway Train.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Which, for some reason, that week, everybody was putting on the internet. I think they were doing jokes about something was happening in the world. So his little
when you
moment
met him?
When
or...
I met him, so I said, you know, you're on the internet all over with Runaway Train. And he said, man, I saw that movie.
A clip and all?
Yeah, there was a clip that was all over YouTube.
No, I didn't know that.
People were sending it around Twitter for some reason. And he was so delighted. He said, "Oh yeah, people like me. Isn't that great?" He was just the sweetest guy.
Doing this very popular show on Showtime, it's helped bring him back into front of many, many more people. I mean, and he's doing again. I haven't been watching lately, but the first couple of seasons I watched, his work on it was just so moving.
Yeah,
you know. Anyway, so I also do want to talk a little bit to go back to Alan Arbus, because he's another actor who there's an opacity. I don't have a sense of who this guy was, but he's intriguing to me, and I can't even tell you why. You know, I only know him from MASH and from your movie. I'm sure I've seen him in one or two other roles.
He made a very bizarre movie with Robert Downey Sr.
Robert Downey, that's what I remember.
Greaser's Palace.
Yes, right, I
saw
that.
He plays Jesus in a zoot suit. Who
right,
parachutes
Robert Downey was on the show.
Into a western town in the 1870s.
Yeah.
And it's a...
Yeah. I don't want the other one.
It's a terrific, terrific movie. You know, Arbus, what's interesting in our movie is he gets to play a complete role from beginning to end. So his character, you meet him at the beginning and you take him to the end, which is an opportunity he didn't have in most movies. He would come in as a, you know, an ornament on the cake, you know, of the cake that is a movie. You know, he'd be a rose or he'd be a swirl in our picture. He's the driving force of a part of the plot.
Okay.
So he runs through the movie and you get to see different gradations of his character.
Yeah, it's
Garfield. Aside from a movie he made when he was very, very young, Chief Zaboo's his only leading role. So Alan Garfield must have made 120 movies,
right.
But only in Chief Zaboo is he the lead,
right.
Where you see him with an arc of a character and all these different emotions he goes through. And it's a beautiful opportunity to see a great actor given an opportunity and what he can do.
I think he was more than that, because in this particular movie, he becomes the romantic lead.
That's right.
And when that happens, people really take notice.
I was looking through his filmography because I knew him from some early roles. He was part of that De Palma and, you know, that whole group of actors coming from experimental film and from underground film,
sure.
At least, you know, to some degree. He was, of course, in like one of those early De Palma movies
with
De Niro.
Well, he also did Cry Uncle, which was John Avildsen's movie right before Avildsen did Rocky.
So, but he was also, of course, I mean, and then, of course, most people will remember his, at least his role, from The Conversation, where, you know, he has a... It's not a lead, but it's a supporting role, but it's very, very central to the film.
And Nashville and the Candidate.
And Nashville, where I just watched again the other, literally last week.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who came over, and she said she'd never seen Nashville my age. And I said,
"Gotta see it."
I said, "You are so lucky." And she goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "You're about to get to see Nashville for the first time."
Yeah.
What a great experience. That's right. He's in that. He was
he's
always
in Beverly Hills Cop. A lot of people know him.
Well,
from
that. Endless number of supporting commercial roles. But he was, for a lot of it, you know, a heavy set actor.
Mm-hmm.
Not
sweaty,
burly. Yeah, kind of always playing sleazy roles when he was allowed himself to be the when you're cast typecast. He was typecast often in sleazy roles but here he's slimmed down, gotten a haircut, if that's his hair.
Right.
I don't know. I guess that was maybe a hairpiece. But anyway, the point doesn't matter.
It does matter. It was a hairpiece, and I kept looking at it. I felt without, you know.
Yeah, yes, I understand.
Anyway.
Like, wait, you know. But he looked very. I thought he looked as healthy in his that he ever looked, and finally, as you already said, he was able to play the leading role in a movie and the romantic lead. As you said, what was his deal? What was he like? I know he's still alive, but he's not doing great.
Right, he had a stroke.
Oh, okay,
and he can't speak.
Okay,
he can hear.
He's there.
He's there.
Oh,
we go see him. We read him reviews. We tell him what's happening with the movie.
He's thrilled.
Absolutely delighted. We've got the posters up in his room.
Okay.
And
please play him this.
Yeah.
Or
yeah. No. Absolutely.
Or let him know about it.
Oh, we sure will.
That there's somebody in New York who was.
Oh yeah. We
about
tell
him
people are talking about him, and he's absolutely delighted.
And he's made a difference. You know. Now, but just also ask him about the. Then you go through a period where he changed his name back to his original.
Yes, he changed his name to Gorowitz, which was his original name.
Right.
I don't know what sprung that, why he sprung that on people. It was for Cotton Club. I think that was his title credit. He did two other movies, and then he decided he was Alan Garfield. Yeah.
Probably wise.
I think if you know Alan, you know, he was always reaching to say, who am I really? At a certain point, he said, I'm Gorowitz.
Yeah.
And he went back for a while.
He's not the only one who's
realized,
done that, by the
way. No, exactly.
There have been other actors who changed their names.
Listen, when I go get my license, I go as Zucker. And on my passport, I've got both names. And it's quite confusing.
Well, you'll always be Sugarman. Yeah. I'll always think of you as Sugarman.
Sugarman, that's right. Sugarman. I could have been Sugarman.
Well, I was thinking of you, Sugarman.
Sugarman, that's good too. But it's great, you know, now Neil never had a problem because he liked his name and he stayed with it. Cohen he changed, but Neil is the original real name.
He's joking.
I am joking.
Well, I'll even at this point admit that I have to done the name game. I did because you know I have a sort of ethnic name. It's Shartov. It's comes from Eastern European derivation. It was probably Shartovsky or Shartov, but you know my family comes from most of it from Russia originally. Right. But when I my younger days when I was writing music and I come from a music background and I was performing, I used my mom's maiden name because I thought it would be easier to spell. and people would remember it.
Was her name?
Heimowitz. No, I kid. I kid. It's Fine, F-I-N-E.
Fine.
So for a while, I put out that I was Adam Fine. I advertised myself as Adam Fine. Sure enough, people, it's much easier for people to remember that and spell it correctly and all that.
Well, I saw it when I took the name Norman that maybe I would think about my mother's maiden name. And then I realized that you couldn't go anywhere with that name. It was Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Yeah.
You see what happened?
Of course.
And Bloomberg comes from outside of Boston.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's right, of course. Yeah.
My family was in the furniture business.
Mine too.
Is that so?
My grandfather, yeah.
Yeah. How about yours, Neil?
The toy business.
Everybody got a business. Isn't that something? No, but it's great. I had an agent by the name of not Chartoff, but Chartoff.
Sure,
Irving Chartoff.
Oh, and Robert Chartoff produced
Rocky movies, that's right. But this guy was booking people, like he booked me in Canada because I was working in one place. He said, "There's a great place in Montreal that you'll stop and work there." When I was working as a comic. And he said, and then you'll come back to New York. So I went into the club in Montreal, and I was speaking, and the people were looking and smiling, and I was sweating. And at the end of the show, nobody had laughed. And I was in my dressing room, and the owner of the club threw the door open. He said, "What are you doing? The man told me you speak French."
Of course.
And I said, "He did?" Because they didn't know what the hell I was talking about. Cool. Anyway, what a great place.
Québécois. Well, I do have an uncle, though, my dad's uncle, whose name, he was a Hollywood agent. And he changed his name. He took off all the ethnic, stripped it of all ethnicity, so it became Char.
Char.
So he went by Jules. His name was Jules, and he went by Char, and he was lived in the Hollywood Hills with his wife, who was a casting director for ABC. And together they were they mutual beards.
Wow.
And they lived.
They were known as the Shars?
Her name was, I think it was Bernstein, Ina Bernstein. I could be wrong about her last name. She was known at ABC. He was an agent for a lot of TV stars, mostly.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I did have an uncle in the business. But,
wow.
Because I went out there and I visited him once or twice.
Well, I never asked John Voight what his real name was. Why does he laugh when I speak? It's
it's a curious thing.
Yes.
Oh, how did you guys meet?
It's a great story.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you interrupt, too.
I was a playwright.
You still are a playwright.
But mostly I was a waiter, bartender, and busboy. And so I did a play agent came to see the play. The play was very nice. People liked it. And this agent came backstage to tell me how much he liked the play. And he said to me, I said, "Great, you're an agent. How can you get me some work?" And the guy said, "Absolutely." And he said, "You could start on Monday as my assistant." So that's how a playwright became the assistant to an agent. And so I became an assistant to an agent and a mini agent. And this agent said, "Two very strange people are coming up to our office. You handle them. I don't want to." And the people who came up to the office were Robert Downey Sr. and Zach Norman. And they were looking to cast an actress named Tammy Grimes in a movie they were making. Now, I knew who Robert Downey Sr. was. The guy who hired me had no idea. So I was all over these guys. I was so excited, and I was working with them and talking with them. And after our meeting, I walked them out to the elevator. And Zach said to me, because he's a very wise man, he said, "You look like a very miserable person." And I said, "I'm so unhappy." And he said, "Well, what would you like to be doing?" This is at the elevator. This is at the elevator.
This is me. No. Well, this was me from my life experience. Looking at a guy who is full of energy, intelligence, it seemed to me, but he was not looking like a happy guy.
I said, what I want to be is a writer. So he said, well, do you have anything to show me that you've written? And I said, as a matter of fact, I do. So I slipped him a couple of scripts. I ran back to my office, took a couple of scripts out of my drawer, met him at the elevator, gave him the scripts. And a couple of days later, he called me. He said, why don't you quit your job and come work for me? We'll write some scripts together. I'll hire you. And that's how we met.
And that's how we wrote a movie called Chief Zabu. And that's no kidding.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what I was trying to say, though, in terms of my comment about real estate, was that you recognize you had gone through the similar,
metamorphosis.
Know, yeah, and you know, dilemma, which is dilemma. Feeling stuck.
You know, I didn't even know, and most people don't know. Thank goodness for them, that I was stuck. It's only when I started to deal in consciousness.
Right.
The most important word that I realized I'm not a happy guy.
Yeah.
So, but it really took an act that was out of my hands, because success really got me out and got me thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's such a great thing. And with him, we had such a good time because we wrote, I don't know, two or three scripts. And really, in retrospect, we really liked them. It's like Zabu. They were different.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
But it's great. And I'm so elated. Don't forget, he was much younger than me, and he still is, which is really impossible. But it seemed like, you know, he was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and now look at us. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
I mean, one of the interesting things as we play Chief Zabu, and what your audience who is hearing this for the first time has to understand, this is a movie that was shot in 1986 and was never played to any audience. It was never publicly shown until now. So nobody's seen this movie. So we have a lot of audiences that are younger people, film people, cult film people, and a lot of these people are 28 or 30 years old, and they feel somehow they missed the train. You know, they're not famous. They're not 30 under 30 on somebody's list of important writers or filmmakers or directors. And we explain to them, well, we didn't make our first movie till I was 35 and Zach was 46. And so a lot of people at 27 and 28 are saying, it didn't happen. I came out of film school and it didn't happen. I got to stop. I got to do something else. We hadn't even gotten started until 10 years later from where a lot of these people are ready to give up.
And look what happened to us.
Exactly. On top of the world, Ma.
So you better go into real estate and stop all this crazy.
Exactly. There's too many people in real estate anyway.
That's right. They're all, you know? And they're all making money.
So do you guys, as you do your bit of a road trip or a road tour with the film, and you're stopping at some different comedy clubs around, do you have a plan, or is there a strategy for what will happen to the film after? In other words, now, of course, we have different platforms for streaming, or there'll be physical media.
Do you want to take it?
Sure, Zach has a better idea of the business plan. I can't necessarily, make my checkbook balance, but a lot of your listeners don't know what a checkbook is, so that's okay. But as we're playing around the country, you see, if we just go to VOD or streaming right now, it'll be a pebble in a pond, and it'll disappear. Nobody's heard of Chief Zabu outside of you, your listeners. People have seen it in L.A. and are going to see it in New York. And so what we're trying to do is gain attention for the name. We're getting press for it. So we got coverage in The Hollywood Reporter. We're going to be getting coverage in The New York Times. But in each town, we want to get that coverage, reach out to people. And then when the name is an entity, then we'll make our streaming and VOD deal, because the people who've approached us already quickly want to put us on some streaming platform, but nobody's heard of the film yet. And right now, we're just having so much fun touring with it that's how we're helping to promote the title and the name.
The point is, when somebody ultimately, maybe a year from now or so, after we've done our 50-city tour on the comedy circuit, they'll see 25 pictures, names of pictures in front of them. And we believe that they're going to say, wait a second, I heard of that Chief Zabu, and they're going to press that button. And that button's going to mean $3 or $6. And cumulatively, it'll mean that Neil will go back to writing his play again. And that's the key to the deal.
I mean, most people who are doing their indie films, at the point when they're done with their film, they're exhausted. And they've run out of money, and they owe all kinds of people money who have to write off their investment.
Well, no, their
so they've quickly got to make a deal
sure.
to show the beginning, middle, and end of business.
And I think you are taking a great route, or you're taking which is a grassroots one, and I think that's perfect for what you're doing. I was saying when the time comes and you feel like you've planted the seeds and you've done that good work, at that point, you will maybe want to do a small, let's say, run of DVDs for a certain specialty market, for which you can then market through the comedy, you know,
correct,
your comedy club roots. I don't know if you're collecting emails now, but if you aren't, I should suggest you try to do so. When is your New York appearance?
It's Thursday, the August 17th.
Okay. So it's coming right up.
Yeah.
And I think if you can try to get either somebody with a device or just the old-fashioned way of passing around, you know, or having it at the entrance where you can have people put emails and do that from now on, because comes a time and you'll want to be able to reach out to those people and let them know, you know, through your email, through newsletter or whatever you do, that there is going to be more screenings or eventually some other platforms where the film's going to be available, spread the word. These are going to be your ambassadors in a way.
Yeah.
So it's a good idea, you know. Yeah, we should talk.
Yes, we will.
As I venture into new FilmWax enterprises, FilmWax distribution, FilmWax. I have a question also for my own curiosity because of I've been in touch with Henry.
Right. Henry Jaglom.
Henry Jaglom, who is a real mocker. No, he's a real, you know, pioneer. People, but a lot of people, because of choices he's made and because of the industry, and he sort of stayed true.
He stayed to himself.
Exactly.
He makes the pictures
he's
wants to make.
He's not been a guy who's been trendy and who's, you know, made moves to stay trendy or anything like that. He's just stayed true and done what he's done year in and year out for now 5 decades.
That's right. And he's got a great love for what he does, and I've done with him so many
pictures.
Well, 12 off the top of my head.
And again, you're going to reference the piece.
That's right. The relationship began
with tracks,
which but as you know, the story that we I met him in a coffee shop. A mutual friend put us together, and we talked. And he told me about tracks, and I said, "Let me get involved." And because don't forget, I came out of the real estate business, and I learned about things that I didn't understand were applicable to the movie business. That's called appreciation and depreciation.
Mm-hmm.
It's called tax shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So he got a hold of me through people that he knew that I could perhaps help him raise money for tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did dig the concept.
It's a great concept.
It's wonderful.
It was part of actually when he was still part of the BBS organization, which was relatively short.
This is where the story goes very quickly.
Okay.
When I went out and raised the money for tracks, he said to me, and I had been with him in Cannes that very year, and it was 1974, and I went to a screening, and the screening was for a picture called Hearts and Minds.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
And Hearts and Minds, I looked at and said, wow, this was really something. And P.S., a long story short, Columbia Pictures, who financed Hearts and Minds, got so frightened by the movie and by the reaction that the government was having with it that they pulled out of the deal.
Four tracks, or
in case anyone doesn't know, Hearts and Minds was a feature documentary that was a scathing look at the Vietnam War. So Columbia Pictures, with their shareholders and whatnot, got scared and dropped plans to distribute the movie, where Zach stepped in.
Well, I stepped in because Henry is really the catalyst, because he called me up, his relationship with Bert Schneider
from BBS.
Yeah, so. And, you know, he said to me, told me the story about Columbia, and I really had loved the picture so much. So Henry said, why don't we take the money from tracks that we have and let's go buy the picture from Columbia.
Hearts and Minds.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
So I went over there and made a deal. I won't go into the complexity of it. That's another time. But I bought the picture and then went over to Warner Brothers and made a deal for them to distribute the picture. So this is why, and I'm, don't get me wrong, I loved the picture. And there it was, Hearts and Minds, that opened by a guy who was United Artists Theater Circuit, pragmatic, commercial guys named Nafee. You ever hear of those names? Bob and Marshall Nafee. I had a relationship with Marshall Nafee, who introduced me to Bob, and they threw a picture out of Century City, or actually in Beverly Hills, to allow Hearts and Minds to play the week to qualify for the Academy Awards.
Okay. You needed like a week-long run.
Yeah,
New York,
a week-long run. Right. And there it was. And I was mind-boggled. As much as I loved it, I really wasn't a politically active person.
Right.
So when the picture was shown, people kept coming up to me and holding their fist and say, man, you did it. And I looked around if they were looking at somebody else. But it's probably the most important thing I ever did in terms of affecting lives and people.
Yeah, right.
It was just spectacular. Spectacular.
And those investors who gave you money for tracks, I guess they invested in you because and in Henry or because
they may have,
they
but
to,
there's
you,
a reason.
You have to go back.
A strange reason, too.
Okay.
Because as soon as the picture opened, by virtue of the structure, which it was changed in 1976, but by virtue of the structure that came out of the real estate business and all the companies were doing it, when the picture opened, if the guy invested $100,000, right, and he was in a 50% bracket tax-wise, he immediately would write off $666,000 for the 100. Cut it in half, 50%, that's $333,000. Now, you don't want me getting more numbers, do you?
And now we're in a convertible driving up the Taconic.
In other words, they made their money, man, before a person bought a ticket.
Amazing.
That stuff is over. There are other things they do now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a great, great story. By the way, I brought up the scene, another scene in the movie, which is gets a lot of laughs, and I noticed in your little sizzle reel that you have on your website, which is tzabu.com, right?
Right.
That, and by extension, I want to say you're very active on Twitter.
Oh.
People can find you if you search Twitter, tzabu. That, but there's a scene of where you guys are, where
Ben Sidney and Sammy Brooks
and Sammy are driving up.
Up the Taconic
there's
Highway.
There's a couple of scenes.
Right.
Right. And it is the Taconic.
It is the Taconic.
So where is this? First of all, I'm curious to know, where is the mansion?
Well,
and don't tell me it's Bard College.
It is Bard
because
College.
Because that's where I went to.
It is Bard. In fact, the entire movie is filmed at Bard College.
Maybe I knew this through our emails.
We spent a day and a half on the streets of New York.
Yeah.
Going into doorways. And anytime you walk into a doorway while you're watching Chief Zabu,
yes.
The next scene, you're somewhere inside Bard College.
Yeah, I could see that.
And
they
so,
all look like...
right, so we had the rooms that doubled as the Plaza Hotel,
right,
and real estate offices and the insides of mansions.
Shot it all and in Annandale and Hudson.
In 2.5, so, in, yeah, 15 days.
It's
yeah.
funny because it keeps coming around recently. Remember last week I was doing a podcast with the filmmaker Eric Schaefer, and I don't know if you know his work, but he is similar to Henry in the sense that he has a career of making, and Woody, and making films like on his own. And although he's had a few with very big names, and he's, you know, part of the system, he'll fall in and out of it. But he too went to Bard College. I wasn't there long, but I was there. And my year that I was there, it turns out Eric, this other guy, was like already a junior or senior. But well, I would have been gone before the, you shot the movie.
Well, there's two things that are quite interesting apropos Bard College.
Yeah.
If anyone ever went to Bard College, Chief Zabu is a snapshot of a Bard College physically that doesn't exist anymore.
I know.
When we shot the movie, all the roadways were surrounded by forests, which have all been cut down for new buildings.
Yeah.
The buildings themselves, the facades have been changed.
The
it's a fascinating...
The theater burnt down, I hear.
Exactly.
And it was now replaced by a very, very impressive modern theater.
There's modern art. There's sculptures, giant sculptures. So anyone who knew Bard or is interested in seeing Bard in the 80s, if they see this movie, it's literally a time capsule. What's fascinating to us, we thought Bard College would be so delighted by the resurrection of Chief Zabu, which we're happy to say part of it is because Bard College was such nice to host us. They have been giving us a stiff arm. The film department refuses to show it. Nobody will return any. It's just the craziest
thing. And they
still
have the same president. Leon Botstein.
Yeah, I don't know if it's trickled up to him, but...
Back in the early 80s when I attended, I'm just saying, he was the youngest college president ever.
Yeah.
And he's probably 30. I mean, he was so young back then. Now he's...
Yeah.
An older man.
But you ask him.
I believe he's still there.
He is still there, and he does wonderful summer programs, and he conducts music. He writes music. He's a very, very trippy, interesting guy. But their film department... Whatever. But there is this driving scene where the two principals are driving, heading up to the rich guy's house where they assume they're going to get a check to finance this entire deal. And the two actors are Alan Garfield and Zach Norman, playing Ben Sidney and Sammy Brooks. And this drive in this convertible is a lifetime arc of these two people's hopes and dreams played out in a scene that's one of the most extraordinarily competent improv scenes you will ever see in cinema. You may not like this movie, but it's worth sitting through 40 minutes to get to see this 5-minute uncut scene. And what's fascinating about that scene is there are no cuts, there are no angles, and there's actually no crew, no director, no cameraman. It's so imagine a scene
you put a
shot
GoPro
no
in the hood of your car.
What happened? Close. In those days, we didn't have any permits.
Right.
We didn't have any tow car. We didn't have any way to shoot the scene except to chain a board of wood to the hood of Zach's Mercedes. On this board of wood was bolted a 35mm camera with a reel of film. The mic
one time
was put on a briefcase, which is in the car. And we said to Alan, who is a very big actor studio guy now, Alan, can't do any of that actor studio stuff. Let's do it again. Let's try it again. Let's do it again. Let's stop the camera. Zach, he's the director. Zach said, Alan, listen, we got one reel, one intact reel. We either get this scene or we don't get it. He says, yes, boy, I'll follow you. And so we sent them off the highway. The DP pressed the button to start the camera. And about 100 yards ahead of them, I'm sitting in an open station wagon with the DP, who is the great Frank Prinzi. And they're driving the car and playing a scene and there's no crew. There's no director. It became true to life. It became completely real. Now, Frank, who's the DP, is watching them through binoculars. And I'm so naive, I say, are you checking to see if it's in focus? and he very kindly laughs at me and says, no, I'm simply seeing if the counter on the camera is still running. Right. Because they're hitting potholes. He wants see if the camera has shut off and when the reel runs out. And when he saw that the reel ran out, that was the end of the scene. And it's as a human being, I will tell you, it is a quite remarkable piece of acting and comedy if you come see Chief Zabu.
We'll see it. Yeah, I'm going to tell people to go see it.
I enjoyed it very much because nobody could bother me.
Right.
I was just out on the road.
Right, exactly. You don't have anybody looking at you askance.
That's right. Saying cut.
Check ChiefZabu.com. Check their Facebook page. Check their Twitter account. Stay in touch with Chief Zabu in case you want to know more or be in touch. You guys are probably, I'm going to guess, available if people reach out to you.
Been reaching out to us, and we are available.
He's available. Very, very. I was born too early.
I understand.
That's my problem.
You're off the grid. I got it. Peter Bogdanovich says it's outrageous. Funny, funny, funny.
Yes,
I got that pull quote.
Yes, absolutely.
We are going to help along, whatever we can do from FilmWax.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's been
really appreciate
delight.
It, and I just love talking to you. I want you to know.
Oh, that's
I don't
nice.
Want to just leave it with Neil and myself. I mean, it's so wonderful that people can hear about the real nitty-gritty instead of a couple of, you know, flashy headlines. It's so nice to know. And he left out one thing that hurt me a little bit.
Oh.
Because, you know, we did a day and a half in New York City, and we did 15 days at Bard College. But he forgot about the half a day we spent at my timeshare in St. Croix. And that became Tibaraku.
That's right.
That's right, man.
That
was important
scene.
To me because we all went down, had a little vacation, and one afternoon we did the shooting.
I really enjoyed this. It's as I feel it's winding down to the end of this particular time.
Sure.
This particular, I'm feeling a little bit of sadness, and because you know all the good things come to an end. All conversations.
He doesn't work for the agent anymore, and things evolve.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And I hope that you take this extraordinary podcast, not this one, but plural, and start to affect people's lives more. And that means growing your own thing and touching people because they need it.
Yeah, thank you.
We all do.
I appreciate it. And that is the plan. That is the plan. So it's great. To bring on people like yourself and Neil, who clearly are, you know, champions of what I'm doing. And I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You know,
thank you so much. It's been wonderful, Adam.
Thank you, guys. Griffin Dunne, one of my favorites. I mean, you know, you go back, you remember, of course, he's been around forever producing and directing. But, you know, he made a couple of very seminal films or was in a couple of very seminal films in my young life, including, of course, An American Werewolf in London. And then After Hours, which he's got some information about that movie and or that story. We had some time left over after we, you know, ended talking about Joan Didion and The Center Will Not Hold. And then we ended up talking a little bit about After Hours and also the series that he does, I think it's on Amazon, called I Love Dick, which co-stars, of course, Kevin Bacon. And we're hoping there'll be a second season of that. You should go check out that show. It's so entertaining. It's terrific. And then we talk, of course, again, for the most part, about this very exceptional documentary called Joan Didion, the Future Will Not Hold. And, you know, I keep running into Mr. Dunn. I ran into him at a panel that he did at the New York Film Festival. And not long before that, I ran into him at a theater, an off-Broadway theater, which we were both attending. And before that, I was really set on getting him back on the podcast. And fortunately, thank you to everybody who made it happen, including my friends over at Falco. Let's go right now to that conversation. Again, the movie, Joan Didion, will be playing at the Metrograph here in New York City. Great place to see a movie. As of Friday, October 27th, and will also be going on Netflix this weekend. If you are home, go watch this fantastic documentary. All right, folks, here we go. My conversation with a returning Griffin Dunn, only on Film Wax Radio.
My first notebook was given to me by my mother with the suggestion that I amuse myself by writing down my thoughts. I didn't have any real clear picture of how to do it, but I do remember having a very clear sense that I wanted this to continue.
Joan Didion is quite extraordinary.
And unexpected.
Joan's writing would grab the reader.
What a fresh voice.
She's writing about all sorts of disorder.
I've always found that if I examine something, it's less scary.
She wanted to go there. She wanted to get in on that.
Boom. And that, and all of a sudden, you were a figure.
My husband, my daughter, and me.
We finally got a house.
Everybody showed up at this house. Steven Spielberg, Marty Scorsese, Warren Beatty.
Everything, you know, seemed to be going so well.
The interesting part of the story is the failure to plan for misfortune.
You've been doing a lot of this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? Tired of it?
Not at all.
Good.
No,
excited?
I love this movie. I'll talk to anybody.
Oh, very good.
I'm like ready to go.
Okay. Well, don't let me slow down that momentum and that enthusiasm, but I do want to mention one thing.
Yeah.
It's a connection. And one of all of the weirdest things in the world, I'm meeting with Garnett Kellman tomorrow.
Barnett,
that's what I said.
No kidding.
Yeah, I'm actually sitting in a studio doing the audio commentary for Straight Time tomorrow.
No.
Of all the places in the world.
That it has an audio. Well, you're going to love him. He's the best.
You're in that movie, by the way.
I certainly am. He's an old, old friend. He's just a great guy.
Oh, that's good to know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't have any other reason to believe otherwise, but I'm actually looking. I watched it the other day for the first time, and I'm have to kind of rewatch again.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I'm going to actually need to be on it with him.
Sometimes
you're just there in case something, they just want, you know, they need you. But this case, they asked me to sit in with him and do the commentary. So it's me, Dolly, and Griffin.
And Dolly's doing it too?
No.
Oh.
But in my heart. In my heart. Anyway, and the other thing, Jerry Schatzberg, he did this podcast.
Great.
So it's a serious podcast. I mean business. Uh-huh. Jerry directed, of course, Panic in Needle Park, which your aunt and uncle co-wrote in their
My dad produced.
And your dad produced it. So it was a real family.
And I'm an extra in it.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you play, like a...
I'm just a kid walking through a supermarket. You don't even
good
see
enough.
Me.
So where to begin with this? Let's just start at the kind of at the beginning.
You.
First of all, beautiful, beautiful film. The first thing I saw at the New York Film Festival, press screenings, first thing I saw, absolutely so happy that I saw it.
Oh, good. Me too.
And I said, whoever made this film, get him on this. You were actually on once with the and I meant to look up the title again, but it was the one where you're the dad, and, you know, and you're the kids in the woods. And recent, about 4 years ago.
Oh, Discoverers.
The Discoverers.
And that's where we last talked.
Yeah. With the director. Anyway, so do you feel like you're the only one who could have told this story, or it was just a driving urge?
No. There was no driving urge. I while making a short film with Joan that she had asked me to make to promote Blue Nights, I loved the experience. We had so much fun doing it. And I became aware of that there was no... there'd never been a documentary about her before, by her own choice. Mm-hmm. And I kind of thought, I'm in a really unique situation of knowing her and being a filmmaker and the only one probably in a position that she would allow, if she did, to tell her story. Which, you know, I think she allowed this to happen because we were related. Not just as a nepotism thing, but we'd be talking about people in our past, in our mutual past, mm-hmm. that both of us shared enormous love for, who are no longer here, being John and Quintana, and we're talking about my dad and my mom and, you know, my sister, and so there was a very much of a very strong family connection. Joan is extremely family oriented. You know, family is particularly the Dunns. From the moment, even though she's, you know, from strong Western stock, she had a very strong connection with the Irish Catholic immigrant side of the Dunns. Mm-hmm. So I think all of those aspects are kind of led to her saying, oh, okay, go ahead.
Did you, I know your dad passed away 6 or 7, pardon me if I'm getting too,
yeah, sorry.
But and your mother's, she's gone, or she?
She is also gone. She died of MS in the mid-90s, 1995.
It's been a while. But so I wonder also if you had, after that, if you found yourself growing closer to your Aunt Joan, just sort of in a natural way that, I don't know.
We were...
Movie aside.
Sure. No, of course. We were always very close for whatever reason. John and Joan. And when John was alive, that was one word, John and Joan.
Yeah.
And they always included me in their lives, socially and just hang out time. And so I was, always close to them, growing up. And then when they moved to New York, and I was an adult, and they were here, I just seamlessly ended up, you know, we ended up very easily back in each other's lives, or back in each other's city. And so, you know, I got to know Joan as Joan on her own, Joan, you know, after John died. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was a truly new experience, because I can count on my hand the number of times I've ever seen them separated, you know, since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was really establishing Joan with Joan. And when John died, my father was alive, and he sort of stepped into the John role. And then when he died, I did. But you know, it was two sides, you know, her friends and family adjusting to one half of a couple, but more devastatingly, Joan dealing with being the other half of the couple that survived.
Yeah, there's an intimacy there, but the dynamic, especially because there seems like it's the two of you now, you know.
Yeah,
to some degree.
Yeah, and, yeah. No, that's quite right. Actually.
You know, and it was, the time was really ripe for this, you know, project, and there, because there was an intimacy and a trust and a bond there that comes through in the film. I won't get as necessarily as far to say that there is a sense that you're taking care of her in this film, maybe a little, but she seems pretty fiercely able to do that on her own.
She certainly, you know, does. She has a very strong group of friends.
Some of whom are in the film.
Tom
exactly. Trilling is in the film.
And so, you know, she has dinner, people over for dinner, you know, 4 nights a week.
Oh, yeah. So she's still very much.
She's there. She just got a dog that I helped her find, quite honestly.
Name?
Ellie.
Okay.
Ellie, rescue dog. Had to be a very particular kind of dog that was like the dog she sees in the park, this soft-haired Wheaton Terrier. Uh-huh. And my girlfriend and I really went through every online rescue animal thing you can imagine. I joined the Soft Hair Wheaton Terrier Society.
On the AKA site or whatever, the American Kennel Association.
Eventually we found a lovely family in Boston who had to part with their dog, and now Ellie lies at Joan's feet, like, and growls if you get too close.
Where did the title come from? The title, because I haven't mentioned it, but I probably will have in the, and certainly in the intro, the center will not hold.
It is from the Yeats poem, where Slouching Towards Bethlehem, and also borrowed the title from. It is referring to what Joan experienced when she went to the Haight-Ashbury during the Summer of Love. You know, while others were looking at hippies making out
50 years ago, right now
coming up. Yes, yeah, that's right. Or just passed. Actually.
I think it was 67. Was the Summer of Love, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, you're good at the math.
Well, I just was also at Woodstock this weekend. You were there. Oh, right?
Oh, at the Woodstock Film Festival.
Don't think I ran into you there, but which is
the
first.
They showed the movie there as well.
Yeah, and you were supposed to talk to Ms. Sarandon, who fell ill or something. She got sick. She couldn't make it.
She got, like, pneumonia or something.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Is that right? Oh, that's too bad. I hope she does okay.
Yeah, I'm sure she is.
But you were saying, I'm sorry. So I was thinking while I was there, oh, my goodness, the next year they're going to have the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. And then it made me remember that, because I kept seeing photos of of Michael Lang, who's
That's right. Yeah, he was
the founder.
Exactly.
Of that.
Yeah, he was there with another doc, actually.
Oh.
About
Shep Gordon.
Shep Gordon.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. So she
went there, Summer of Love. You know, while other people are looking at hippies and free love and, you know, it's all so groovy, she's looking at the children. And the disillusion of the family and all the runaways that were attracted there and that were heavily involved in drugs. And when, she's paraphrasing, or she's using the line, center will not hold. And we're using it in the same way of the center of the family not holding together.
Hmm.
And, but it's also about, in that same essay, is her, Joan, coming to terms with disorder, which is what she's been doing all her life. And she chronicles disorder in American society and then later, tragically, in her own life.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the book, Slashing Towards Bethlehem through The Blue Knight, since both of those have come up, which kind of bookends her publishing career, you mentioned, I think it was at the New York Film Festival, where I saw a panel that you participated in on documentary filmmaking, and I think you mentioned that leading into the film in preparation for, you read all her books chronologically. Did you say that?
Yeah, I did.
Had you not read them before, or were you just?
No, I've read her books.
I figure some of them at least.
Yeah. No. I mean, uh-huh. I mean, one of our brother, sister, parents, every Christmas. We would get a from either of them a signed copy,
mm-hmm.
you know, with a personal inscription in. I'd read all of her books,
mm-hmm.
But what I meant was, you know, those are spread out over years.
Yeah.
So I'd not read them all in basically one sitting, and not in the order in which they were written.
Uh-huh.
So I started with the very first piece that she wrote for Vogue at the age of 22, that she wrote on Deadline, this just brilliant, incisive, contract with yourself on, you know, with your morals,
mm-hmm.
On morality. And, by which she's sort of lived by her whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And carried it all the way through. And when you immerse yourself in that, you come out knowing, no matter who the writer is, you know a lot about them just from
sure. It's an intense
phrasing,
and it's a very intense experience to just read through all that in, you know, in a relatively concentrated period of time.
Absolutely,
I guess,
right? Absolutely right.
Because you're really going through a journey there, which you can't really build the momentum for reading it over 20, 30 years or more.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
You mentioned how close the family was, and yet in the making of this film, it's called Joan Didion, so it's about Joan and her family primarily, but I noticed you did keep your own nuclear family, other than maybe the visits to the California space, because that was such an important nostalgic period of mm-hmm. time for you, but you kept kind of those stories out of her.
I did, very much for that the reason that you said, and they were in. That's how I know that I kind of had to take them in, take them out.
Very interesting.
Yeah, Joan wasn't a writer, and I took out all the writing stuff. I could have made a feature film just about our two families, you know?
Yeah, right.
And it would just be like two families. Both.
I actually think it would have been still a great film, but this wouldn't have been this film.
It wouldn't have been this film. Yeah. And I was hired to do this film, and that's it wasn't just for me, you know, without putting too heavy a point on it, I really did feel the presence and an obligation from her readers, who are a passionate group, who were really hungry for this movie, and they were drawn to Joan by her work. Well, I think many from the Julian Wasser photo of her standing in front of the stingray, mm-hmm. and then her work. Not all of them, but I think that was a huge lure. But nonetheless, she has a very, her readers, you know, have really been influenced by what they do for a living and where they live and the choices that they make and where they were in life when they read that particular essay. And, you know, there are very few writers that have that visceral a connection with, mm-hmm. with their reader. So nobody had done a doc about her before, so this is also for them. And they would be, rightly so, bitterly disappointed if it was just a family tale.
You know, as I think about it, having a long career, it something makes for a great backdrop for a story like a documentary like this. But it's really the backdrop. I mean, the real story is what's going on during that, you know, which,
yeah.
But it does give it the framework, you know, well, so you can enjoy it on different levels, but the truth behind the film is something else.
Yeah, and it's not just what's going on in your life when you're writing something. It's also what's going on in the world
mm-hmm.
about that you at that point in your life have chosen to write about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really three things. It's history and cultural history and, you know, where the doors are and where or fighting in Salvador or when the Manson murders.
Right.
But it's you know, Joan wrote about that as Joan.
Mm-hmm.
As Joan, who will mention in the piece, I have a daughter and a husband. So they're all in the air.
Right. Interesting. What does she make of this time now? Can she even grapple with
You know, the news, the 24-hour news thing is plays in the kitchen constantly. And
right.
She, you know, she reads the paper and she's researching different sort of things. But I think as a president, this guy is ultimately, for her as a writer and a journalist, really quite boring.
Yeah.
You know, what she prefers is someone who's brilliantly evil trying to convey a message to throw people off what they're really saying and having Joan go underneath that public message and say, this is what they're really saying. And this is why the New York Times wrote this. Well, this, while the Times was writing that, the New Amsterdam you know, up in Harlem are writing this. And what's the connective tissue here?
Yeah.
And
There's no subtext.
There's no there. It's like it's like ass to mouth.
Yeah.
into a microphone or a camera or whatever.
Yeah. Right.
And it's a constantly changing thing, and there's no, you know, there is no message.
There's no message. Well, there's no center. To,
there's no center,
center
to,
at all. So that's the problem with this. It's a center-free environment. And it's a Netflix film.
It is a Netflix film.
Did they
film.
Come in as a producer, or did they? You complete it? I can't remember. I know you talked about this.
It came about when we had done a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
And we, with the Kickstarter, you have this on-camera plea, and we made a short. And you know, we've been to other financiers before. Who I think, you know, had the proper respect for Joan, but kind of thought, well, it's a documentary about a writer, you know, how exciting can that be? But we did a...
well, the Baldwin did pretty good.
What?
That James Baldwin last year did pretty good.
When it works, it works.
Yeah.
You know, and,
yeah.
and that works, hopefully, the way mine will. Mm-hmm. It's in a historical context. It's the writer... talking about the times of which they're living and how, you know, if their observations and essays, you know, if they still are relevant or tell us about where we are, if they're still prescient, you know. And that was kind of the feel of our trailer. So when Netflix saw that trailer, and they also saw how quickly we hit our goal, and the online chatter went viral, like crazy viral. I've never seen anything like it. And then they went, as we suspected, there's an audience for this. This is actually, you know, this is about a woman, and it's about a family, and it's about our country.
I saw a photo of you and her in the box,
yeah.
You know, seat at the Alice Tully Hall, right?
Mm-hmm.
And where they shine. It's a tradition for those listening that after the film, the director and the whomever that's there in the box, they'll shine the light so you can have your bow and, you know, nod to the audience. And then you come down and do your Q&A. I assume that wasn't the first time she saw it.
That was not the first time she saw it.
But on a big screen, maybe it was?
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And for me, too.
Oh, yeah? Is that right?
Never. No.
So what was that like for you then?
Well, it was incredible. And to see it on the big screen and have Joan right there beside me.
Holding
and then,
your hand?
Yeah, with a little hand-holding going on.
Know.
Sure,
just,
why not?
In my mind, that's what's happening.
Sure, no. More that thing where you grip somebody's arm,
and
you're so proud. And
yeah. White knuckling, too.
Yeah. But no, she'd seen cuts along the way, I always had. But that was... that was an incredible thing that happened that night. I mean, it was the movie ended. They do the traditional hitting the box with a spotlight, and standing with her, looking at those, you know, 1,000 whatever people, looking up with tears in their eyes with this 10-minute standing ovation.
Really?
I thought,
wow.
I thought, well, isn't that great? Uh-huh. Joan's in her 80s, and this is what she gets to see, you know.
Yeah.
That all of the, it was like the culmination of all the love that had accrued based on all the work that had accrued, you know, kind of culminated where so many people could in real time show her how much they love her. You know, it was no small matter.
It also legitimizes now finally you figured out what you want to do. You're a documentary filmmaker. So after all these wayward years, you finally...
Well, I hadn't thought of it like that. I still have to be making a narrative here and there.
No, I'm sure. So what could be furthest on the spectrum from that film? Again, it's called Joan Didion, The Center Will Not Hold, which will be on Netflix on the 27th, Friday the 27th of October.
Correct.
And select theaters, too, for a limited kind of...
Right? Here in Manhattan at the Metrograph.
The Metrograph. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, love that
they
place.
It's a really great spot, and they have a beautiful, beautiful theater, beautifully projected. It's the perfect...
True movie lovers, you know, and as someone who has lived in New York a long time, you know, and I'd seen Bleecker Street, you know, go out of business, and the Regency,
sure.
and...
Many.
All these that were just there... for because they love movies.
Well, there's a resurgence, as you see it. You're a New Yorker, so you know that, you know, there's movie theaters popping up again.
Absolutely. Which is kind of great to see.
It is great to see, especially the irony, the tension between the SVOD and then as well as new theaters cropping up. It's great. Yeah. It's nice. And then, I mean, when I say that, I mean not just huge cineplexes for more superhero films, but for room for us all.
There is,
for everybody. You know, lots of different stories, right? Speaking of which, I Love Dick, season two. Season one was pretty entertaining, I have to say.
It was certainly entertaining to be in, I'll tell you.
Pretty far in the other side of the
We're
the
still waiting. Apparently, you know, they're writing away, so we're just waiting to find out what happens.
Oh, really? So, I would have. I just figured it was all done in the
not ruled out, but not ruled in. Mm-hmm. We're sort of in tenderhooks ourselves.
Okay.
For season two,
we'll have a season two. Jill Soloway's.
I would think so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was very fun to watch you. A lot of physical comedy. A lot of
I love doing that show.
Yeah,
I just loved it.
Yeah, it was very good. That's the end of my questions, actually.
All right.
Well, I mean, you know, I feel like it was a nice, robust conversation about Joan Didion and the film. And I'm completely satisfied with it.
Oh, good. I am, too. If you're satiated, so am I.
Well, barely. We can just say for people of my generation, which is just barely actually from yours, I should admit. But have to mention for my friends that are listening, when I told them I'm bringing you on, they're the people who wanted me to mention After Hours, of course, which was a big deal to everybody.
Sure.
You produced that, too, as starred in it.
I did.
Was that some sort of deal with Martin Scorsese that you would have the
That's what I feared. But Amy Robinson, my partner, found the script, Joe Minion's script, and we were partners on two movies before, and she actually, you know, she was Teresa in Mean Streets, so she knew Marty. And
yeah, right.
There was you know, Bob Harvey, woman in the middle. That was Teresa, the chick. She got it.
Wait,
she
let
got
me just clarify. When you're referring to Bob and Harvey, I have
oh my
to
God,
clarify.
How about that?
I have to clarify
oh,
something.
For God's sakes, now I can't even say Bob and Harvey. Son of a bitch. When Robert De Niro and Harvey Keitel were in that movie.
Yeah.
So,
was that also, by the way, I can't remember if that was the film that was sort of Martin's agreement after New York, New York and King of Comedy. That he would make a more crowd. That's the way it was, you know, couched.
Yeah.
I don't
well,
know.
Well, no,
that,
I mean,
or he made it in because he wanted to make Last Temptation of Christ. I can't remember.
No. He was actually shooting. He was not available to us when we first went with him to the script because he was shooting Last Temptation of Christ. Hadn't started, but was about to shoot it with Aidan Quinn as our Lord and Savior, and the financing was pulled.
Oh.
And he was sort of in director's jail. Because King of Comedy, as brilliant as it was, you know, lost a lot of money.
Yeah.
So he wanted to make this movie. One of the reasons he wanted to make this movie was to show that he knew how to make movies the way he did when he did Mean Streets and Boxcar Bertha, you know, tightened to the ground. And you know, he said publicly and to us, you know, it got him falling in love with making movies again.
Oh.
So.
Well.
We're making it as a series, too, by the way. After Hours is a series. It'll be.
Oh, so it's actually germane of me to bring that up.
It turns out
to be. I don't feel so guilty. Yeah, there's always that problem. I'm such a always worried. You know, I'm an empathetic kind of guy, and I'm always thinking, don't bring up something old that's so hackneyed.
Yeah, I used to be bugged by shit like that too. But
good. You let that go. You're beyond that now.
I'm evolved. But yeah, we're.
So tell me about that. What's
you know, very
you're breaking
early
news
stages.
Here?
I
here on Film Wax Radio.
It's going to be spread out. It'll be one night, spread out. Over 10 episodes, and if it's successful, and it goes on another season, it'll be anthologized. So Paul Hackett could be a woman, and the city could be Shanghai.
Right.
And it'll be a different city with a different set of problems.
Misadventure.
Yeah. Kind of. And in this, the obstacle is technology, which, you know, rules our lives, let's face it. And it goes against you.
Well, it was one of those very truthful comedies because, as all great comedies have a lot of truth in them, of course, that's why we laugh, but that we've all sort of had that kind of night in, you know, in our young adulthood or whenever, where you just can't
escape. Everybody's had that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so worse. Can you do me a tiny favor? And it's just to say, do a little ID thing.
Okay.
So this is the name of the show, in case you've forgotten. I wrote it down for you. So you could say the director of Joan Didion, if you want, whatever you want to say, and just say something, and then you're listening to.
Or that. I could just say, this is Griffin Dunn. You're listening to Film Max Radio. Is that good?
Yeah, anything like that is great.
Right. This is Griffin Dunn, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Perfect. So I was given the one more question, sign, so I may as well ask. What else is. So you have After Hours, the series, which will probably be 2018 or 2019.
Oh, yeah.
That's down the road. Yeah. You're developing that, I assume.
Developing. That's, and then that's early development.
But what about maybe acting or directing?
I just finished, came back recently from...
Mm-hmm.
Came back recently from Italy, Ravello, Italy, where Gore Vidal lived. And we shot a movie called Gore that Kevin Spacey plays Gore Vidal. And we shot it in Gore's actual house.
Is it still owned by his estate or something? Or
no, it's got a different owner who let us shoot there.
That's cool.
And I play Lenny Bernstein.
You just happened to write West Side Story.
Just
whatever.
Yeah, no slouch. And I got the hair for it. It was incredibly fun.
It's you know, you bring it up, Joan, your aunt. Gore Vidal. There's obviously the documentary Voyeur, which is about
Gay Talese.
Maybe it's there's a resurgence of those
action-packed writers.
They're so cinematic. Well, they are, though.
Yeah, absolutely. No,
I think Gorman goes back a little bit further, but anyway. So it's kind of the literary epic is, or what have you. It's great.
Marvel,
to see.
Pay attention.
That's right. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk
Always.
To you.
I'm glad we could do this.
Me too. Thank you, everybody. I believe, finally, I'm not going to keep saying the boy cried wolf about my Kickstarter, but it is actually happening. I think we'll hold off to the next episode. I'll probably have a much more specific idea. Reshot my video, which was one of the things that was putting this off, and I think during the hurricanes, I just didn't feel right asking, you know, doing an ask. So we're now at a point where, you know, I feel more than ever it's the timing is right. So we're going to have that off the ground in just a couple of days. We've got a couple of episodes I got to post coming up, and here they are. We have coming up right after this is going to be doing an episode with a few things I want to get out really quickly. One is with I'm doing a special Halloween episode. My friend Larry Fessenden, who's been on this podcast a number of times, has a series of audio plays that he does called Tales from Beyond the Pale, which are all the, you know, which he does, which he started with the filmmaker Glenn McQuaid. And the two of them are going to be on the podcast to talk about their new recording that is coming out called Tales from Beyond the Pale 4. It's the fourth collection, and it's actually, I think it's currently available, and you can get it right now. So that will be, we're talking to Larry and to Glenn about that coming up in a couple of days. And on also that episode, Horror Queen, Barbara Crampton. For you horror fans who have been into horror for many years, you know who Barbara Crampton is, and she'll be on the episode as well. So keep an ear out for that coming up. I'm also going to be doing a special episode coming up on sexual harassment and the whole story in the news, starting, of course, with going back to CineFamily, to the Fantastic Fest and Alamo Drafthouse recent story, and, of course, the Harvey Weinstein and Roy Price and everybody else. This is now so ubiquitous in this particular industry, as well as others, but specifically in this business, that it would be kind of odd if I didn't explore it in this platform that I've created. So I've invited on several filmmakers to come on and talk about this story, this situation as it is, and that will be coming up also in the next couple of episodes. And that was, by the way, great. And it's going to be the first of, I think, a couple of the segments I'm going to be doing on the subject. So keep tuning in for that. And then I'm going to bring on the founder of Independent Lens, the PBS documentary series, Lois Vossen. She'll be on shortly. And I'm barely scraping the surface. I have so much coming up. It's a bit overwhelming, hence my recent increase of episodes. So expect that to continue through the next month or two while I do this campaign and whatnot. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for going on to iTunes and writing a review and giving me a star rating. Thanks for that. Thanks for following Film Wax Radio on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram and on YouTube. We're everywhere. And we're going to only be even more everywhere. We're going to be everywhere plus in a matter of a month or so after this Kickstarter is over, because I'm going to try it now. I'll have more help and I'll have more opportunities and to put the show out there on other platforms. So be expecting Film Wax Radio to even be more broadly available in the coming months leading into 2018 and beyond. Thank you for listening. My name is Adam Sharktoff. This has been episode 438 of the podcast. We'll be back, as I mentioned, in a couple of days. In the meantime, as I always end the show, please, please, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, do take care of yourself and the ones you love. Until next time, thank you. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken eyes.